Welcome to Wolf Cub Film Club, a show where my dad, Steve Thomas, and I, Daniel Thomas, from opposite sides of the globe, explore top films. On this episode, we'll be taking a look at a new doco called Subject, which examines the impact of some well-known documentaries on the lives of their subjects, with a focus on the ethics and responsibility inherent in documentary filmmaking. Wolf and I are excited to bring you this episode, as we've been lucky enough to be joined by our first guest on the show, Margie Ratliff, who features in Subject. I'll let Dad introduce the doco further, then we'll get into our interview with Margie. Please stay tuned after the interview, as I also took a moment to ask Dad about his own approach as a filmmaker to documentary ethics. Enjoy this one, guys.
Subject is a documentary that's been needed, I think, for some time. It's a film which looks at the experiences of participants in documentaries. The directors and filmmakers are not interviewed, although there are commentators who are interviewed, but they're not the filmmakers. And this is a film that looks at five seminal, if you like, American documentaries, and looks at the stories of participation of main characters within those films. It's directed by Jennifer Teixeira and Camilla Hay, who together form Lady and Bird Films. And it includes, as I said, five docos, of which The Staircase is one. And they interview one of the daughters of Michael Peterson, the adopted daughters, Margie Ratliff, who is present throughout the Staircase documentary series. Jesse Friedman from Capturing the Friedmans, which is a 2003 doco about a Jewish family where the father and son are accused and convicted of paedophilia. Jesse Friedman is the son. The father, Arnold Friedman, I think has since passed away. They look at Hoop Dreams, famous doco about black kids playing basketball in New York, which was even older than Capturing the Friedmans, released in 1994. Then there's The Wolfpack, a 2015 film about, I think it's five or six boys in a family who've never been allowed out of doors. They've been kept in their high-rise apartment by their parents. And finally, they look at a participant in The Square, 2013 doco, about the uprising in Egypt, the popular uprising of the time. I said that they don't interview the filmmakers, but there are some commentators. And interestingly, they include a couple of friends of ours, Kirsten Johnson, who, of course, made Dick Johnson Is Dead, a doco that we really loved and which we reviewed in Series 1 of the film club. And also Davis Guggenheim, the maker of the Michael Fox doco, which we looked at more recently. So, yeah, that's the kind of background for the film. And the interest for us, I guess, is that Margie Ratliff, who was a participant in The Staircase and is a participant in Subject, is actually a producer of the film. So she worked with the filmmakers.
It's a very important doco, as you say. It's the first of its kind, as far as I'm aware. And in terms of the impact and the ethics regarding subjects, it's not new territory, but looking at these particular examples and how things were handled, particularly with The Staircase, there's potentially a lot of different things in terms of how subjects are nurtured and respected when they potentially sign up to things.
At this point, our discussion could move into our special guest.
Yeah, I think we should announce our special guest. It's a real privilege that Wolf and I have arranged to have Margie Ratliff on the show with a focus on her involvement primarily in this film subject.
In which she talks about her participation in the staircase and the whole saga of the staircase from Woe to Go. Margie, welcome, and thank you very much for giving your time to us for this little discussion on our humble little podcast. If we could go back to the beginning and work forward a little bit. You were, I believe, 20 years old when your mum died. And when not only were you dealing with that, but your dad is charged with her murder. And then at some stage, a documentary crew turn up. Can you sort of fill that in for us a bit and tell us about how you felt at the time as a 20-year-old with all this going on?
Yes, it was right in the middle of my sophomore year of college, and I was in college pretty far away from home. So it felt surreal to be juggling such an immense sadness and confusion and fear at home, but then go to college and, you know, be expected to perform at a normal college student level and have, you know, friendships and things like that keep on going. But really, it took, at that time, I was thinking about things in semesters, so maybe half a year, for the French documentary film crew that came in, Jean-Xavier de Lestrade, came in, and they were looking for a story in the courts in the United States that was about a family and a love story. So they approached my dad's lawyers, and my dad's lawyers talked with my dad, and those were those kind of like older adult decisions that were made, that it would be best to just get as many eyes on the case as possible. And if this was a social justice lens, then that's okay too. And then it got filtered down to us as not a question if it was okay, but more a, we're doing this. So there was never really a consent on our part as the children. We just said, okay, Dad, we'll do whatever you need to do if you and your lawyers think this is the right thing to do.
Right. I identify with the... How did you cope at uni? I mean, I was at uni. I was in my first year, and no one had told me, but my dad was very ill. And the first thing I heard was a phone call to say he'd passed away, without any warning whatsoever. And so I kind of rushed home, as you probably did. And then I had to go back and do my end of first year exams, and I flunked them completely. And I had to go back after the summer and redo them.
You weren't given the opportunity to even say goodbye.
No, never mind prepare. So, yeah, was it pretty disruptive, Margie?
Yes, I think it's safe to say. And I'm so sorry that you would, without giving time to prepare, it's almost like it was an accident in that way. But knowing, I just can't even imagine what you went through. Especially, I mean, my sister was a freshman. That was her first year when our mom died. And so I think that really affected her in the way that, she, you know, your first year, you're still making friends and figuring out your career, you know, your path in university. And for me, I had already kind of made a lot of friends groups and had a strong support in college, but my mental health severely struggled. I leaned heavily on the counseling department at my school, and then my dad's trial knocked me out of pretty much a whole year of university. So then it took me longer to graduate as well.
So at what point did the doco start to sort of intervene and you began to feel uncomfortable about all that?
I was actually in college for film and German. So I was doing both majors, film studies major and kind of working in the film industry a bit in my college town. And so for me, I was excited that there were professional filmmakers that I could chat with, but I didn't like being filmed, and I didn't like talking about my family and talking about what was going on at all. It felt really invasive. But I knew that I, so I mean, I look back at a little bit of the footage from the staircase and go, yeah, I was the one in the corner. I didn't want to talk. I think my sister was felt a little bit more comfortable in front of the camera, but I really didn't want to. But there was no space for me to voice that. And then, but also I was, you know, the film crew was there almost every day at our house. And so we would have meals with them and they would be the only smiling face behind the cameras at my dad's court. Isabel, their cinematographer would sometimes, you know, move away from the camera when we were going through really tough points in the trial and just smile at us. So I started to really love the film team, but at the same time feel that anxiety and frustration about being filmed. And then it kept on going for another 12 or 13, 14 years. And every time that, you know, I'd get filmed, I would pull away a little bit more, or they kind of have to trick me a little bit into filming me. And especially as I got an MFA in documentary filmmaking, I started to feel like, no, I don't think this is okay. What's happening?
So you were coming at it from a more informed sense, really, because you were studying film. I notice in the doco there's a cutaway in court. You're reading a book called Gender and Something in German Cinema.
That's what my one of my final papers was on in undergrad.
How's your level of German now? Do you speak German?
Yeah. I was just at the Nuremberg International Human Rights Film Festival, and I couldn't do the Q&A in German, but I got along fine.
Yeah, cool. I was gonna say, just it's very different, but also just a relatable thing. Dad actually made a documentary about my football team when I was 16, and it's obviously very, very different to the doco series that you're involved in. But he followed my under 16s team for the year. And I know in subject you talked about being self-conscious, and the classic thing in the doco we did is that my voice broke halfway through the year. So, and the doco was jumping back in time. And so in one scene I had this very high-pitched voice, and in the next scene I had this very, and objectively I'm really proud of the film, especially in hindsight, but I could relate to you about that, that being self-conscious on camera so young as well.
I do think that's interesting, a difference between our age groups and the understanding of that, and then maybe Gen Z and younger, is that the younger generations have lived their whole lives understanding what they look like on camera, and maybe understanding that better than what they look like in the mirror. So it's kind of a conversation I end up having with people my age and a little bit older that really understand what that feels like to see yourself for the first time on a big screen and understand that weight and fear.
Yeah. The soccer doco was a bit of a circus, really, because Danny would be telling me how to make the film and I'd be telling him how to play soccer. But it worked out okay.
I've got a two-part question for you, Margie. Do you feel you were more affected by the documentary team or the media coverage? Which had more of an impact, or was it all kind of one and the same?
That's a good question. I think at the time I was very aware of the media and how detrimental they were to my mental health and what was going on. And it felt like the film crew, even though it was frustrating being filmed, the film crew were not on our legal team at all, but like on our emotional team. And then my relationship started to shift as the press died down, but the documentary started to move forward. Then it was hard for me to be around the documentary because it just was like a catalyst of all of the trauma that I had gone through in the past. So the relationship really did start to change. And then once the Netflix sale and the HBO Max option, those were when things really started to click in my brain and push me to make the film Subject.
Well, we'll come to Subject in a minute. I mean, you're going through trauma at this stage, the trauma of your mum's death and the trial and all of that. And you're being forced to go through that trauma publicly, aren't you, essentially?
Actually, I understand that documentaries often do handle topics where the participants are being traumatized or have gone through severe trauma. I think that's part of us being good story partners and telling documentaries is finding people who could benefit and their stories could help other people by being told. So I don't think that filming trauma is in itself a problem. I think maybe going towards only trauma stories and making them, you know, the way they are on Netflix, that is a problem. But I think it's more how that trauma is held and taken care of. So I've just started a nonprofit that's helping participants, you know, who have been in documentaries or are interested in being in them, get mental health care and get legal access and advocacy, because I think it's so important that if we are going through trauma or talking about it, that we have the help there and someone to help us move through and make it a more transformative experience to be in a documentary.
Yeah. And you didn't have that help?
No, my sister and I, when we were going through such traumatic experiences, we were lucky enough to understand we needed help. So we both separately in our own ways pursued mental health.
Independently of the crew and everything that was going on.
Yes, definitely. There, especially for a French documentary crew, if you know the culture of France at all, you would understand that at that time there was no chance that, you know, a psychologist would come in and help us out. I think that even in the U.S., that wasn't very standard back then.
What do you think they could have done differently at the time? The actual documentary crew, could they, like, in those early stages, what do you think they could have or should have done differently?
I think that it first starts with consent. So sitting down with each one of us and talking to us about what it looks like to be in a documentary and what that might feel like for us and what the future of the documentary might be. They had made Murder on a Sunday Morning, another documentary, with a young boy. And so they had seen at least what the experience was like for him right after the film was released. So I think they could have sat down with us. And if we could have had our own lawyer present, maybe not my dad's defense lawyer, but another, you know, maybe human rights lawyer or something like that, and walked through an actual release form. We didn't even get to sign release forms until way later, and they were for different episodes. So it's just that idea of consent and really knowing and having the option to say no. Even if I had stuck my foot down and said, I'm not going to do a seated interview, they still would have filmed me in my house because I was there the whole time. So I think that idea of consent right from the get-go. And then also keeping us updated on what was happening. The only way that I knew that the Netflix sale even happened is because I'm still good friends with the editors. And they told me. But no one called my dad and told him what was happening. And then the optioning of the HBO Max series is just unacceptable. To make it a fiction film with actors and give the kind of access that they did to all of the footage, not even in the documentary.
Yeah, we'll come on to that in a minute. Just stepping back, Dan, you said it was a two-part question.
I have a strong interest in personal development, and I notice in Subject you mentioned you were preparing or done the LA Marathon, and I also noticed that you were rock climbing. Are these type of hobbies still present in your life, and how have they helped you process this whole experience in any way?
Yes. I don't even know how to explain how much running and rock climbing have helped me in these different stages. I'm still running. Rock climbing is a little bit hard as I travel around with my film. But the rock climbing really, really pulled me out of a tough time in my life. And I have a fear of heights. And so instead of focusing on all the other fears of my life, I was just focusing on this one fear of heights because it was so real when you're up on the rock. And so that I was able to find a new, more supportive friend group through rock climbing and kind of move through a lot of depression and sadness that was going on at the time around when my dad was, you know, all these new hearings were coming up later on. And then the running, actually running the, it's so interesting, but when everything's so meta in my life, when we were filming for Dr. Phil, they put my dad up in, you know, some nice hotel in Beverly Hills. And so I stayed with him for, you know, a night or something like that after the filming, and we got to have dinner and have a nice chat. But I was already feeling kind of like I needed a little bit of space for my dad, but I didn't know how to do it. And then, you know, a few days later, I'm out running the LA Marathon with my uncle, and we run past that hotel. And I tell my uncle, right now is the happiest I've been near this hotel. I love running right now. And I don't want to talk to my dad for a little bit. And I'm going to tell him that. So it was really these kinds of realizations that when you put your body through maybe a little bit of stress, I think in a positive way, that it can help unlock some emotions. That's a whole nother podcast.
It is. I didn't want to. But what an awesome outlet. Like, you know, we actually have a giant like rock climbing center over here, which is amazing. Like it's a big indoor when I take my son in there, it's pretty cool here in Germany.
Well, let's step forward, Marty. You're now 30 years old. Your dad's been in prison, I don't know, for 8 years or whatever. Appeals are happening and so on. The documentary crew come back to make another 3 or 4 eps. How was that for you? And did you at that stage put your foot down, or were there changes in protocols? Did anything change, or was it more of the same?
Basically, The Staircase 2 started being filmed when I was actually, yeah, because my dad got out of prison, what was it, 3 days after my 30th birthday. It was strange because I was excited to see there had been a little, you know, we had seen the documentary crew throughout the years because of my dad's appeals. And I had then formed a personal relationship with them and had spent a lot of my summers in Paris with them as my friends. And so I was excited to see my friends again from the documentary crew, but I really didn't want to be filmed. And so, you know, I remember there was one time where we all got together to meet up at the beginning when we all got there, and we had like a nice lunch together, and everyone was so happy. And some of my dad's strong supporters were there, and it felt really good. Like maybe our dad will get out. This could be really good. And then they said, "Oh, we'll take you back to the hotel." And then they were kind of fixing up my hair a little bit. And I was going, what are you doing? Because I said I didn't want to be filmed. And then they said, oh, could you drive? And then I was like, okay, I'll drive. And then, you know, Isabella has out her camera and they say, oh, turn here. And so we're driving past our old house, which I had said I had been having nightmares about. And they're filming me. And those were the kinds of things that the older I got, the stronger I felt in saying no, and the more frustrating it got when that no was not respected.
It's interesting, isn't it? Even the best documentary makers can be really sneaky. How do you deal with that in terms of if you're making a documentary? I guess you've got to be constantly self-questioning about what you're doing.
Yeah, I do think, and it's tough because these days, a lot of independent filmmakers, if you have the footage, then at some point you lose control over that footage. So now it's not just a matter of what goes in the edit. It really is, when do you turn your camera on and when do you turn it off? And I think that if you're looking at filmmaking, a documentary filmmaking, actually even fiction filmmaking about real people, as trying to get to the truest version of the story, but not at the expense of the story holders, of the protagonists or participants of your film, but in collaboration with them, that you're going to get the most interesting, best versions of the story and the clearest versions of the story if you don't use coercion. And if you, I think Michelle Stevenson says it in our film subject of, you know, you'll leave a slew of bodies behind. She uses that as a metaphor, but it's, would you treat your own family this way? I think you really need to start looking at, are there more ethical practices that maybe every time this person going through trauma sobs and cries, maybe you don't have to turn the camera on every single time because you're not going to get a good interview out of them.
Yeah. And of course, you had, I was going to say the double whammy, but it was a triple whammy, wasn't it? You thought things were kind of over and done with the first screening of the series. Then Netflix arrive. And then on top of that, HBO decide to make a drama. And in subject, that's just happening, I think. The drama's just happening. And you're kind of throwing your hands up in horror at how many times you have to go through this. Do you want to talk a little bit about that experience? Because it's unexpected, isn't it? Once you've committed to a doco, you don't know the future life of that film.
Yes, there's no way when my mom passed away in December of 2001, we could have known what the word streaming meant. What the possibilities for documentary distribution, what AI, you know, besides like robot movies, AI was not something we talked about at all. And that could be the next wave of the staircase. Who knows? And so I think what comes with all of these waves is new knowledge about my own mental health and more tools in order to make me be able to cope with it. But that next step I had to take was action, and was, instead of hiding, I think when the Netflix series came out, I said, I can't hide from this anymore. I'm working in the film industry in LA and my bosses don't even know about The Staircase. No one knows about it. My new friends that I've met at the climbing gym don't know about it. And so when I said, okay, well, everybody's going to know about it now, that's when I started to step into new projects and say, okay, maybe I can do some good with this and turn this around for my family. And that's when I met Camilla Hall and Jennifer Teixeira of Subject, and we went on the journey together.
Right. Before we get to that journey, though, I remember you telling me in Melbourne when we met briefly that all HBO had to do was buy the rights from the French filmmakers. There was no compulsion on them and they didn't consult you or your family at all. That seems to me to be, I mean, it may be legally correct, but it's ethically wrong, isn't it?
Yes, I have a whole host of things to say about the ethics of the HBO Max series. And I do know that the creator of the HBO Max series did go through the correct channels of law to option the rights to the Staircase documentary. The added extra step, which in itself, if you're not consulting the family and if the documentary never got the life rights for these participants, then that is questionable whether you can make a fiction film about it in the law, I would say. And also then French filmmakers saying, hey, here's the footage from The Staircase and all of our other footage and Margie's footage that she shot as a child that we never got access, got a release form for. And so giving them just a open menu of everything. I can't even watch the trailer for the HBO Max series. It's so triggering.
Right. So you haven't watched the series?
There's no way. There's no way I'm going to watch that series.
I must say, Margie, in subject, when you talk about that, the actress who was going to play you wanting to speak to you. I'm an actor myself, and I've actually often wondered what it would be like to play a role of somebody who's even still alive. And it actually, your response actually really resonated with me and changed my perspective, because I absolutely agree with you in terms of what you said about she's suddenly being paid and she just wants to call you and get all this stuff. So to hear your stance on that was actually refreshing, in that it changed my own perspective in a way about the ethics of, in a narrative sense, how to approach that.
What did happen, Margie?
So it's interesting because I actually kind of had that kind of conversation with an actor earlier on in my career. So I had a friend who had come out to LA from Chicago, where I went to grad school. She came out to LA to be an actor, and she was auditioning for a role in a Lifetime movie that was based on true, some sort of true sad events. And I talked to her and I said, there's been a Lifetime movie made about my family and my family's story, and it is really, really upsetting for my family to know that that's out there and that there are actors playing us. And we just had this long conversation about it. And in the end, she said, "Oh my God, I'm not going to audition for this. What am I thinking? I'll do it an original film, but not something about someone's life." And so I was able, when Sophie Turner then, reached out to me through the HBO Max filmmaker, I was able to have a hard no, because I had already had these conversations and I understood this business is a money exchange. And if there is no talk about money and you are just going to take my story and profit from it, I am done with that. And also, I didn't want to go through, it wasn't just money. That's just a signifier of respect, I think, in our culture. But it was, for me, I didn't want to go through a phone call or a conversation about all of those things. I'm dragging them up in, or dredging them up in trauma therapy, but that's with a therapist present, and for to dial down the sharpness of them, not to help an actor with their character development.
Well, and while we're on money, the Doco series must be making millions. Has your family seen any of those profits?
No, my family has not seen a single profit from any of the staircase iterations. Not zero. There's nothing.
Because in Subject, one of the examples of a film you look at is Hoop Dreams. And when Hoop Dreams went into profit, they did a deal with the participants to share the money, and it's quite substantial sums. So there's a whole portion of Subject that deals with the money side of things.
We respect Steve James and Kartemquin, who made Hoop Dreams, and I hold them up to be, very ethical filmmakers. And they gave, anybody with a speaking role money in the back end. And is that possible? Is that something that you can do? Will distribution even let you do that? So for a long time, I thought, oh, okay, it's besides. The fiction series is another thing, but the documentary at the time, I thought, oh yeah, you don't get paid to be in a documentary. Maybe if you're famous, but otherwise, it's journalism. But now when you start going, wait, but this happened with Hoop Dreams, and what is the wait, who now is a star and who's not a star and who should get paid and who shouldn't get paid? And once you start to unravel all of that, that's when the real questions around compensation start happening.
Okay, so moving on to Subject, how did that come about? Did you just meet up with the filmmakers and they already had this idea, or did you hatch it together? I notice you're an executive producer as well as
I'm
a
a producer.
participant, a producer. Okay, so tell us what happened, how it came about.
Yes, so It was right before Netflix released, you know, the original 8 + 2 + 3 episodes of The Staircase. And I had asked one of my friends in the industry, hey, I know you have some contacts that have kind of always wanted to chat with me about The Staircase, and I never wanted to, but if it can, you know, get me a job at this point, I might as well make some good out of the documentary. And that's when they connected me with Camilla Hall. And we just talked about, you know, we met and talked about other projects, other things she was working on. And maybe I thought I could be a PA, a production assistant on one of them. And then I asked her, oh, but are there any projects that you want to direct, you know, that you're not just producing, but that you also want to direct? And she told me about the idea of Subject and how she had been thinking about past participants she had had in her past films and those kinds of relationships and wanting to understand it from their side. So then I said, oh, well, you know, maybe I could consult on that. And it was just a funny interchange where Camilla hadn't, the news hadn't been released about Netflix. And so she kind of said, oh, The Staircase, some people know about it. It's not that big of a deal, but I'd still love, you know, to hear your perspective. And then I said, oh, it's releasing in over 200 countries on Friday. So at that moment, that's when she said, oh my gosh, what are you doing to take care of yourself? And then I said, oh, I'm climbing out in Joshua Tree National Park. And so at that moment, I told her, okay, I don't really know if I want to go down this path. I need to talk to my family and really figure out if this is what I want to do besides, you know, consulting, but actually being filmed. But why don't you get your camera, you know, camera person ready for this weekend? And then we can talk in a few days and see kind of what role I would take in the film and how this would go.
And so it grew from there and you became a producer. Does that mean you were involved in the development of the story and the selection of participants and so on?
Yes. Yeah. Right from the beginning. And we brought on Jennifer Teixeira. She edited just our, you know, original sizzle reel with Just Me Climbing and the interview. And the three of us went on this journey together. So they were clearly the co-directors and I was more of a producing role. And really, that footage that we had of me climbing got Jesse Friedman and his family interested because they had seen The Staircase and said, oh my gosh, we really feel for that family. It feels like we went through something so similar. And so when Jesse saw, you know, us, he said, oh, well, if Margie's interested in this, maybe I'll think about it. And so from there, it was the snowball of, oh, you know, Jen and I know people at Cartemquin. Let's talk to them about Hoop Dreams. And so we had had a list of films that were really influential for us and that we were hoping that we could get in touch with the participants of. And we went from there. It was about 5 years of shooting, and most of that was through COVID.
You mentioned Jesse Friedman. I mean, a lot of the characters in the film are powerful, but his story is perhaps the saddest story. And I got a great sense when I was watching it of empathy between the film and Jesse. And is that because you saw so much in common with his experience?
We have so much respect for Jesse and his family. I think we stepped into it with the lens of when we approached them with the lens of, okay, we've heard from Margie and, you know, Margie's family story, perhaps Jesse's will be similar. Let's see, you know, what his experience was like. So there was that original connection of similar family trauma that we'd gone through in the spotlight. But then Jesse had his own ideas of ethical filmmaking and his own ideas of what he, you know, wanted out of the impact campaign and the changes he wanted to make. And I think that that's when I decided to kind of step away and fully be a participant instead of doing producing at that stage was I said, I think it's really important for Jesse and his family to have their own experience that's not intermingled with the staircase in our experience. And so that's why I think each, in my mind, each one of the five segments is so uniquely its own.
You know, I get that sense with Jesse. He's very deeply affected by everything that's gone on and appears to be at almost a rock bottom. Whereas you seem to have found a way to, I don't know, bounce back. And perhaps that's because you've taken agency through the making of Subject, for example. Is that how you see it?
It's so complex, this idea of trauma and who moves through it and how they move through it and who's able to. And also, Subject is at a fixed point in time as well. I don't know how Jesse's doing right now, but he might actually be having a grand old time. Who knows? He might have had a breakthrough in therapy or started. I do think he actually started running the last time I chatted with him. So at the time that we were filming the documentary was a really rough time for him, but I actually don't know what his healing journey has been on. There were points when they were filming the staircase where I was in a better spot and then in a worse spot, mental health wise as well.
I was just thinking, as your experience with Subject sort of restored your faith in the process in a way. And is there anything that in terms of moving forward that you guys can take from Subject in terms of, I don't know, call it reform or regulation in the documentary process?
Yes, I think that's one of the most transformative experiences coming out of Subject, is seeing how many nonprofits and people out there are already talking about these things and are so happy that Subject has made it into a film, and that there is a network out there of professors who are teaching about ways to do creative compensation for your participants and make films ethically. And they love having Subject as a tool that they can show their students to really drive the ethical ideas home. And for us, Jennifer moved on, one of our co-directors moved on to produce a documentary series for HBO. And she utilized a lot of the things. So she had mental health practitioners for every person who needed the help. And, you know, once you actually have a budget too, you're able to really do these things. She made sure that HBO Max kept the participants safe because there were safety concerns. She did a consent calendar. So she was able to look at what her deliverables were and what those dates were and tell the participants, okay, by this date, you'll need to decide whether you want to be anonymously on screen or fully on screen. By this date, you know, this is when I lose my power to remove you from the film if you want to be removed. So just letting the participants know what to expect and what the duty of care will be. I think those are some practices that every documentary filmmaker could use in some way. I mean, not every film is the same and it's not a one size fits all, but I think that there are some things that could be across the board.
There is a call in Subject by someone for a code of conduct. What do you think about that, Margie?
I think a code of conduct is basically just the golden rule. It's just treat others the way that you would want to be treated. Honestly, there is a nonprofit called the Documentary Accountability Working Group, DAWG, D-A-W-G. I know how Aussies love their acronyms. And so it's DAWG. And they created a framework for ethical filmmaking. You can find it on their website if you just search D-A-W-G. Or accountability working group. And they looked at this idea of documentary filmmaking from the inflection, you know, like the just the beginning inception of it, all the way to the impact of the film. And the thing that we find most interesting is this reflection phase, even before you approach your participants. So it's this idea of, am I the right person to make this film? What resources do I have to make this film? Do I have the right things needed to go and approach this community. Could I collaborate with someone in the community? You know, what do I want my relationship with the participants to be? What do I have the capacity for it to be? So there are all of these kind of questions that filmmakers can ask themselves before they even get started. And then also I'm working with a nonprofit. I'm just throwing out nonprofits now with a nonprofit called Peace is Loud. And together we're coming up with actual hard resources for participants and filmmakers. And one of them is I'm working on a question list that, you know, if you've been approached to be in a documentary, you can bring this list to the filmmakers and have some questions to start asking them about consent and impact and the process and all the other little things that go into a documentary.
That's interesting. So tell us about your nonprofit, Margie.
It's called the Documentary Participants Empowerment Alliance, and we are interested in bringing legal and mental health advocacy, mediation, community to people who have been in documentaries or are considering being in documentaries, and really to educate the film community, then the film industry, as well as audiences on ethical documentary filmmaking, where participants are taken care of and really held appreciated for the stories that they're holding and that they're telling. And so my goal is at some point to, it's a US nonprofit, and I do want to build it out into a global NGO, and because documentaries aren't just being made in the US, and also develop a kind of stamp that can be put at the end of a documentary to say, this is, you know, the duty of care has been reviewed or worked with the DPEA, and this film has been made, the participants have been treated ethically, you know, so that there's a set of standards that need to be met in order to make sure that your participants are taken care of.
That's awesome.
It could sound a bit like the, you know, no animal was harmed during the making of this film.
It's sad that we've had a stamp for animals and we haven't had a stamp for humans, honestly.
Yeah.
Just to bring it home, I just wanted to say, I just think it's really awesome, given everything that you've been through, to have the courage to now move into a place where you have this kind of mission. It's been a real privilege to hear all about it and try and move forward with this stuff.
Yeah, I think you're terrifically courageous, Margie. And I just wanted to finish by asking you mentioned towards the end of subject that what you would really like to achieve is to strip yourself out of the staircase. Has there been any progress in that ambition?
Thank you all. Thank you so much for your kindness as well. And for the legal proceedings, so at the moment in the courts, at least in the United States, if you and your family have been filmed, even if there's no release form, even if you didn't originally consent, if you've been filmed for a long time, most of the lawyers I've talked to have said, oh, it's implied consent, because you always could have said no. Which, just when we're talking about consent, that in real ethical terms is not consent. Implied consent, consent under duress, which I think were both things going on with the staircase, were not ethically determined. So it's been hard in the courts, and I think what I can do is just change the conversation. And with the DPEA, we can start to have lawyers that actually have, you know, gone through workshops and understood what it is to protect a participant the way that you would protect an animal on set. It's not an exact equation, but it is, you know, when you start to think about that of, oh, we protect children on sets, and we protect, you know, we have unions to protect, you know, the workers on set. But why don't we protect our documentary filmmakers as well as our participants?
Yeah. Yeah. Margie, is there anything else you wanted to say while you've got the opportunity?
And also, where can people find the charity as well?
Oh, yes. Okay. Well, and I do want to say we had the opportunity to travel around at least Eastern Australia with Subject, and what an amazing experience it was. I didn't even know how to pronounce Brisbane, and now I do. And so I had the chance to meet some amazing First Nations people and journalists and activists in Australia, and I have so much respect for the work that's being done as well. So I just wanted to give a little shout out to Aussie. And also our nonprofit, you can find us at dpealliance.org.
Thank you very much, Margie. Do you want me to check with you before we put this to air, or are you happy to just let us rip? It's up to you, really.
Do you mind just, thank you for asking. It's like a consent process. I really like that. I would love to just hear it beforehand. I usually don't have many notes. It's more just like a fact-checking thing about my family.
Yeah, no worries. We'll do that.
Wonderful. Thank you.
It's actually brought to light a little bit the ethics in potentially podcasting as well. Like all this type of interview stuff. It's such new territory with all this technology and the amount of stuff. It just sprung to mind. But yeah, thank you so much for your time as well.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was really awesome to chat to her, and we're very grateful that she gave her time considering the nature of everything that she's experienced. But I wanted to ask you, Dad, in terms of your experience making films, is there anything that stands out to you in terms of ethics and your processes in the films that you have made? And how has that evolved over the years from when you first started to your later projects?
Well, this is the kind of stuff I've been banging on about for years now, and which grew out of my early experience with filmmaking, which was making commissioned documentaries for people like SBS and ABC, and in particular one film where really I was reduced to the role of a process worker, really. I mean, I don't know why they asked me to direct it, given that I have a particular sort of approach and personal style, which they chose to ignore. And not only that, but refused to screen a rough cut of the program or show any version of the program to the participants before it went to air. The first the participants saw of that film was when it was broadcast. And I had a very uncomfortable feeling about that, because I thought that, to be fair to participants, they should have a chance to at least comment on the way that the film was being put together and the way that they were being represented. So after that experience, the films I've made have not been commissioned films. They've been truly independent films and independently funded. And I've been able to develop a kind of ethical approach which is completely in tune with the kind of things that Margie Ratliff is talking about, where consent, you know, I think has to be an ongoing process up until the moment where the film goes into distribution. Participants should have a say. They should be given agency to tell their own stories rather than have their stories told for them. I mean, for me as a director, the participants come first. For the producers, they might be more concerned about the audience, the success of the film, the distribution of the film. I mean, you know, an audience want everybody to spill their guts. Participants may not want to spill their guts. And for me, my first loyalty is to participants. Of course, I want to make a film that's engaging and meaningful and powerful, but not at the expense of the participants. So my basic position is that if the film doesn't benefit the participants in some way, it's not a film that I want to make. I don't work with reluctant participants. I don't work with participants who don't have any investment or stake in the film. And I work with them in a collaborative way to try and ensure that all of our aims are met in the making of the film. And that's hard and it takes a lot more time. But for me, that's the key to good ethical documentary making.
I've witnessed you go through that process growing up. I remember you always being very transparent about the process and having rough cut screenings and feedback and moving as close to being as transparent as you can be, not only in the filmmaking process, but directly with the participants. So it doesn't surprise me that all this is very much in line with your own ethos. I've witnessed that over the years.
But, you know, I've learned through each film, and particularly the feeling of responsibility in the film that I made about Amal, the refugee film, where she died prior to the editing of the film, and I had to struggle through that edit without her to refer to. Every film for me is a kind of personal journey of learning and education as well. And I think the problem with a lot of films is that we really don't know the motivations behind the making of the film unless we read the credits carefully. You can sometimes glean something from that, or if we see or read an interview with the filmmaker, then we get some sense. But for me, it's important for audiences to know where the filmmaker is coming from and what the filmmaker's position is. And so that's why I tend to narrate my own films, acknowledge that this is not an authoritative view on a subject. It's my view on the subject. Making film really is quite difficult because, you know, in cutting down all the material you've shot, you tend to pare away the humanity of your participants along with that process. And I think the editing is ethically more fraught than the filming for that very reason. And when you're filming, you're with a participant, they can express an opinion. But usually when you're editing, it's you, the editor, and their picture. And that's a great responsibility too, I think.
Yeah, I know this from narrative, just that the way the editing can completely reshape a narrative. The editing process, an entirely different film can be made. As an actor, it's different. You throw down and it's out of your hands. But when you're dealing with real life lives, it's very delicate. In acting, I've just had huge concerns about the editing process, but also an acceptance that it's out of my hands if I'm not involved in that aspect. But what do you think of the about the financial remuneration? It's not something I'd ever really considered in documentary.
I think it varies between countries and cultures. And in Australia anyway, and I think in Europe, it's not standard practice to pay people to be involved in documentaries, largely because once you're paying people, then they want to please you. You know, they want to make sure you get your money's worth. And so they might start amending what they're going to say in order to say things that they think you want to hear. But there are arguments. I mean, I've always made the argument for some kind of payment in kind, even if it's a few bottles of wine or a bunch of flowers. Or, you know, when we were making a film about a poor family, we bought the husband a bike to get to work on. This was something we could do legitimately within the budget as a location cost. We weren't paying salaries or paying people cash. So, and the other aspect is Indigenous communities often expect some consideration for their time. And with Freedom Stories, we have a contractual arrangement with the participants that if the film ever goes into profit, then they would see a share of those profits. Of course, the film never has gone into profit. But with a film like Hoop Dreams, for example, which became massive and made millions, they did have an arrangement to pay participants a share of the profits. So I think there's two aspects. There's involvement in the film and should you be compensated? And then there's the question of, well, if the film makes a profit, who gets the proceeds? Of course, I've written a PhD about all this, which if anybody cares to contact me, I can send them a link if they're interested in reading 70,000 words about all this.
That's right. Your PhD
Yes,
was
indeed.
ethics. It was
Indeed, it
ethics-based.
was.
I think the prime example is in your first-person type of work and mentioning the Amal and Hope. What's beautiful without bias and wonderful about that film is when Amal had to become the filmmaker at one point, and you hadn't intended for it, but circumstance meant that she had to take the camera and run with it. And it turned out to just be a wonderfully personal journey between you both. And then also to go back to Jeff, which was a first person story commissioned by SBS. Jeff, had just got out of jail and was giving a first person account of his rehabilitation or attempt at rehabilitation into society. And you were piecing it together and editing the footage. But in both those cases, in terms of ethics and consent, it can still be shaped in the edit, but it's still essentially a first person account. So it's very a lot more transparent, I guess, is my
Well, hopefully my it point. Is. Of course, the film being narrated by the filmmaker doesn't per se make it more transparent. But I think by being conditional about things and saying, well, I suspected this, or I wondered about that, or I was confused about this, or I wanted to find out about that, those kind of statements are much more open and transparent than statements like, this is how it is, voice of God narration, there's no other way of interpreting this situation. The way I'm telling you is the way it is. That's the problem with the voice of God narration. You've got to be much more conditional and cautious about the way you narrate a film, I think. That's what I try and do anyway.
Yeah, cool. It's good to hear your take on it all in and amongst all this exploration.
Thank you for asking.
Thank you for listening, guys. If you have any feedback or filmmaking questions you'd like us to answer, please reach out at lionfuryproductions@gmail.com. We're also on Instagram at Wolf Cub Film Club. Thank you for your support. We'll see you on the next episode, where we'll be looking at the doco series Beckham.